Hey, and I hear that music, and that means it's another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamfrone, and really excited to be with you on this great progressive radio network. And we have a very interesting guest coming on, Dr. Mary Bove, who's actually my esteemed classmate. We went to school together, so I'm very excited to have her on. But just wanted to let you know that we came up with a date for our excursion to Jamaica coming up in March 2014, and you can get more information on that trip if you'd like to join us to study the herbs of Jamaica and study with traditional ethnic healers and Maroon medicine men. And that's going to be again March 15th to the 20th, 2014, and that's at naturalnurse.com or drznaturally.com. And then I think we have a new Facebook page, Eco Tours for Cures. So you can get more information on our walks, talks, events, and all things natural alternative on that website. But with the cold weather setting in, we have a lot more patients coming in with flus, colds, upper respiratory infections, ear infections, sinusitis, all kinds of immune challenges. And we're really excited to have Dr. Bove here to talk a little bit about what you can do from a naturopathic perspective. Now, she got her MD and midwifery certification from Bastyr College of Natural Health Science in Seattle, Washington. I was going to say the most eminent school of naturopathic medicine, but now that I'm involved with University of Bridgeport, I don't think so anymore. But anyway, she also has a diploma of phytotherapy and herbal medicine at the School of Phytotherapy in Great Britain. We want to talk to more about that. And she continues to practice family medicine at Brattleberry Naturopathic Clinic in Brattleberry, Vermont. And she used to be a full-time member at Bastyr, chairing the Department of Botanical Medicine and Naturopathic Midwifery. And she's worked as adjunct faculty for Massachusetts School of Pharmacy and Scottish School of Herbal Medicine in a master's level courses. She's author of Encyclopedia of Natural Healing for Children and Infants. And she's the person to go to when you want more information about how to get the kids to take that natural medicine that may not taste so great. She also co-authored Herbs for Women's Health and has been a luminary in the field, publishing many magazines, journals, and collaborative books on botanicals and natural medicine. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Eugene. Nice to talk to you, Dr. Z.
Yeah, it's great to have you on here. So tell us a little bit about what challenges do people face as the cold weather comes in, and why do you think as a naturopathic doctor that people tend to get more colds and flus and upper respiratory infections during this time? There's a myriad of underlying factors that as a naturopathic physician we look at versus an allopathic physician just focusing purely on the germ theory.
That's right. You know, I think we'll all agree that there are, you know, an increased amount of germs or viruses, but there's also, you know, the fact that we're more indoors, that we're subjected to different types of heating systems, that our allergies can be stimulated during that time, making us more susceptible to be, you know, more susceptible to getting a virus or an influenza or a bacterial infection. Also, you know, there are needs that just happen in the winter, and particularly for all of us that live up in in New England, is that we have less light, and that can definitely affect our immune system. We also have more need for insulation or keeping ourselves warm, and certainly we should be doing that with clothing, but we also need to do that by the types of fats that we eat and having good amounts of good types of omega oils in our diet and our supplement program can make a difference also in our immune system, and particularly in the mucous membranes of the immune system is where a place that many, you know, germs per se might enter the body. And so given that factor, I think that there are many different aspects that can come into play. And if you're, for instance, you know, in the age of 11 through 14 or 15, you're probably not wanting to wear a coat and a hat and mittens, and that's not stylish, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, you need to try to keep those kids warm by making sure that they have, you know, good fats in their diet and enough protein and good burning kinds of fuel and, you know, complex carbohydrates. And that's always a challenge, too, what people are eating, whether that's a teenager or, you know, someone who's overworked in their job, you know, or a child who's finicky or picky in what they will or won't eat.
Yeah, that's a huge concern. It's not just what you absorb, it's what you eat. And you know, I don't know, I think with the lack of light, you mentioned that, and there's changes in the brain chemistry. We kind of follow the seasons. Our own bodies are mirrors of what's
exactly
going on outside. And I think that makes a big difference, particularly if you, you know, pay attention to what the ancients said. Like, for instance, they would always say that, you know, illness would invade the body if the chi was low, especially in TCM, and you had to keep your neck covered and the back of your head. Don't go out with a wet head. All these things that grandma used to say.
Yes, and some of that just comes down to common sense, which is one of the things I think that sometimes we lack when we think about how we take care of ourselves. And, for instance, a little trick that I think is important is that, you know, you mentioned, you know, don't go out with a wet head or keep the back of your neck warm, put a scarf on. Well, many kids, you know, particularly, you know, the kids who are under 10 or 12 who get kind of chronically runny nose or tend to be more cold, those kids need to be, you know, warmed. And one of the tricks that I do is I give those kids, like parents, a warming kind of massage oil or Tiger Balm-based kind of massage oil and have them massage their lower back over their kidneys. If they do that in the morning and in the evening, it really does help to warm the inner, you know, fires, which make a difference in helping someone to stay warm, as does, you know, improving our digestive fires. And so I think that the light, the cold, you know, as you said, and, you know, with the light, it forces us inside and it forces us to be around more artificial light, and that doesn't necessarily provide us with the same that natural light would. So, you know, we can augment our indoor environment by providing full-spectrum light, you know, to help with brain chemistry, as you mentioned, and the whole piece with not only mood and brain chemistry, but also, you know, function in the physiology, such as immune response function and or good circulation and or good, you know, removal of waste. So I think, and that just kind of brings me to remind people that vitamin D definitely plays a part here, you know, not only in, you know, helping the immune system, but helping the mood with the, you know, the dark season. So I think looking at that, whether we're inside a lot or whether we're in a northern area, that does affect how our immune system and our nervous system and our sleep patterns are working.
You know, it's interesting. You read different opinions in the literature. You know, you and I, of course, lecture quite a bit at conferences and whatnot. And we see that, you know, for some people, vitamin D tends to, you know, there's a vitamin D receptor in the cell, and that actually, in some studies, inhibits us from fighting off germs because it has more of an immunotolerance type of effect. Yet clearly, there's also studies that show that vitamin D is helpful for the flu and things like that. So I kind of scratch my head when it comes to vitamin D research. It seems like it's a more immunomodulating, and I'm looking at it more like an adaptogen type of thing or like a steroid, which kind of has a bidirectional yin-yang effect on the body versus just unidirectional like a drug. What's your opinion on that?
Yes, I agree with you. I think that we, you know, the more that we spend time researching and understanding vitamin D, the more we recognize that it does fall where it has that modulating, immunomodulating piece, and that it really is what is that own person's response? What's the body's response, you know, to that? Like you mentioned, an adaptogen. And I think, again, that comes back to individual, you know, naturopathic medicine, where we're always looking at what is this individual, you know, do they support vitamin D anywhere in their diet, what kind of skin do they have, what are their needs as far as growth and development, you know, and when we look at that, you know, I think that helps us to see, is this person a candidate, or is this a risk that could play a part for that person, and that piece of recognizing that the body does have an intelligence that, you know, speaks to what we put in there as medicine, whether it's natural medicine or food or, you know, pharmaceutical drugs.
I know you're a big fan of kind of cool medicine like hydrotherapy and things like that. I know sometimes when people have a lot of congestion, I tell them to do like a wet sock treatment and a fever treatment. Tell us a little bit about how people can use water in its different manifestations, steam, soaks, wraps, compresses, etc., to help us with our immunity.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, especially because
it's free. You know, hydrotherapy
is
free.
It is free. And, you know, we all have the ability to be able to do it, and it really has a lot of history that's shown us that it is very effective. And combined with other types of naturopathic therapies, I think it's great. And you mentioned the wet sock treatment. For me, I think that's a great one, particularly when the onset is coming with that congestion in the sinus area or upper respiratory tract kind of phlegm and congestion or fullness. And I posted on my website how to do it. So I, you know, tell my patients, go to the website and, you know, and there are the instructions so that they can, you know, easily do that. And one of the things that I find is that if you use something like some apple cider vinegar in the hot water in the cold water that you put the socks in, and or you use like a cold infusion of yarrow tea or a cold infusion of peppermint tea and soak the socks in that, then wring them out and put them on with the plastic bags and the wool socks over that and get yourself into bed, that the herbal medicine also helps to augment what's going on. And you mentioned steams and wraps. You know, another one that I really do like is I like not only steams such as volatile oil steams, and which delivers things right to the upper respiratory nasal passages, but I also like vegetable wraps. That's a really easy thing that many people have right in their kitchen, too. For instance, for a sore throat or swollen glands in the throat, you can take a carrot and grate the carrot, add a little bit of lime juice to it, and put that on a cloth and put that over that area of the throat, and that helps very much to diminish the soreness and take the inflammation down. So there are other things right there in the kitchen, you know, that we can use kind of in that kind of hydrotherapy way. And then, of course, there's always the bath, in the sense that with, particularly with younger children, children under the age of 2, using a bath is a great way to deliver a medication through the skin that can actually influence their circulation, their lymphatic and waste removal, as well as their immune kind of nervous response. So, you know, doing a bath with linden flowers and chamomile and lavender flowers can very much boost the immune system and help to, as you said, that fever treatment to bring the body up. But with kids, you don't need to go real, real hot. They don't do well with the same kind of temperature that an adult would use. So with kids, we tend to keep it, you know, at about 99 and just really soak them so that they can medicate with the herbs themselves. And then the last thing that I think is really good to remember is that there are things such as other types of chest rubs and oils that can warm the body and warm the chest and relax behind the ear. And these things all also help with delivering some medicine. So when children don't comply well orally, where they may not want to take a cough medicine or a herbal medicine, or they don't swallow a capsule or a tablet, you know, we can deliver some of these things by soaking the feet in warm water for 10 to 15 minutes and then applying a medicated herbal oil to the feet and keeping them warm so that the reflexes and the skin are taking in some of those medications.
Well, the skin has no taste buds, Dr. Bowe. It's an old
Absolutely.
Saying.
Absolutely, yes.
So feel free to use that. That's a I heard it from some elder at some point, too, and thought that was really an awesome thing. And, you know, it turns out that a lot of the herbs that, that get rid of viruses and well, let me backtrack. You know, when we look at allopathic medicine, we don't find a tremendous amount of really good drugs for viral conditions. I mean, there's a few of them for the flu and, you know, certainly some for herpes and, you know, vaccines for different things. They're pushing the flu vaccine. First of all, what's your opinion on all those things? And second of all, well, I guess, what's your opinion on those things? And then I want to talk about some of the herbs. I just did a fabulous presentation on antiviral, antibacterial, and immune-modulating plants for a local herb shop here, well-attended fun shop that I did with the natural nurse. And, you know, there's a lot of plants, tons of plants, that have a tremendous amount of evidence that they do indeed help people with viruses. Everything from the very bitter, bitter plants, which tend to, I don't know, for some reason, have things in them, not only alkaloids, but certain oils, sesquiterpene, lactones, and some of these fancy chemicals that you and I kind of know about that kill viruses, but also even some of the essential oils seem to really, really... I mean, let's face it, if you could clean your bathroom with thyme and eucalyptus and pine, and we know they kill a tremendous amount of bacteria, viruses, fungi, and other microbes, why shouldn't we be able to use these inside? So first, your comments on the flu shot and how allopaths handle, you know, these things, assaults on the immune system, and then contrast it with our naturopathic approach and kind of meld into those herbal things.
Yes, that's a big question, Dr. Z. Certainly, I think that the medical community doesn't have a lot to offer. That a lot of their medications that they can offer are, you know, more symptom-driven as to relieve symptoms that are caused by these issues. As far as antivirals or the, and particularly like vaccines, I think that, you know, vaccines offer a solution from their perspective, but from a naturopathic perspective and from my own personal perspective, I really am not excited about people getting the flu shot. In fact, you know, I think that there are many things that we can do as a naturopathic physician to aid our patients and to consult people to be able to use natural things that can give us the same kind of outcome. I think that the flu shots give people a false kind of safety of feeling like, oh, I got the flu shot, I can't get the flu, and they don't typically understand the long-term repercussions of, you know, using vaccines, not just the fact that they carry, you know, the active ingredient or the purposeful ingredient, but the inert ingredients in vaccines are, you know, a whole other topic we should talk about as far as toxic and interruptive to our endocrine system and our, you know, overall function and modulation as far as an immune function. So on that bent, I'd rather spend more time on saying, you know, I think that if we can get people to look at naturopathic medicine, as you said, not just, what should I say, antiviral herbs, but herbs that work not only for antiviral, but for also helping the body to deal with how the viruses affect our body. Many people don't recognize that once the virus has taken hold, that it runs its course and we're left with this post-viral type of syndrome, which often is what the symptoms we have. And so looking at using herbal medicine, as you mentioned, something like a very bitter herb, that might be andrographis, for instance, not only is that going to affect the virus itself by having constituents that work against the virus, but andrographis also affects the way our immune system is going to approach the virus and the way our body relies on its foundational immune responses. For instance, we know that andrographis also affects the way that we absorb food and digest food, and so it helps to move the digestive fires, which have a lot to do with, you know, initiating what we would call some of our innate immune response that happens through our gut. So looking at a herbal medicine for flu or antiviral effects, it is like having what I would say a complete package. Many times the herbs deliver us the antiviral activity along with support to the general body and overall. And as you said, there are many, many things that, such as thyme, such as pine, such as other essential oils such as oregano, that we, you know, talk about, oh, we can use these and they disinfect our surfaces. Well, traditionally in botanical medicine, we would have been eating a lot of these types of things in our food stock, in our soups, you know, cooked in with our different types of meats or vegetables, and that is one of the ways in which we can deliver more aromatics. But aromatics make sense in our gut as well, because these plants with the essential oils do help to, support that first line of defense with when many people have viral exposure and don't necessarily get a sickness from it, because their first line of defense is very helpful and helping to mediate that before it takes hold as illness. And when we're using a lot of aromatics, we're constantly refreshing our mucous membranes with aromatic plants and volatile constituents that work as antimicrobes because they release through the body from, you know, in our physiology from that way. So I think it makes sense to drink these herbs as teas, thyme tea, rosemary tea, sage tea, use them in cooking. I also think that if we look at some of the other, local antivirals right in our kitchen, you know, we have cinnamon and ginger and mace and clove, and we have an oregano and basil and marjoram, and all of these, and garlic. All of these plants make sense so much to be including in food, but if you're sick, you can go and make them into medicine or use them as medicine, or to think about the plants that we have available to us in natural medicine, such as using a concentrated form of Melissa, as you said, for herpes, or lindenflower, which a lot of people don't recognize how much lindenflower affects influenzas. And that's tilia, the lindenflower, or limeflower, people know that. So often we get caught in what types of things do we find easily on the market. Elderberry is an antiviral. You know, Melissa is an antiviral. But there are many, many traditional plants that are right here in our kitchen that can provide that as well.
Yeah, I like that, using the food as the medicine. It makes a lot of sense. And then, one of the things that we should backtrack and talk about is that there's kind of like different parts of our immune system. You touched upon, I think you referred to it as kind of like your innate immune system.
Yes.
And then, so there's different types of plants. There's plants that kind of direct, I call them, when I taught bot med for years too, and still do, at UB, I kind of broke it down for the students real simply as direct antimicrobials, and I mean broad spectrum, and kind of indirect. And, you know, some plants do both. They have a direct action, directly killing or lysing a viral envelope or a cell wall of a fungus or something like that. So they directly burst the thing or melt the membrane or do something like that. And then some of them get internally, like Hydrastis and berberine, and they kind of interfere with the RNA and DNA as the bacteria multiply. But some of them are indirect. So some of them require your immune system to kind of be intact a little, and they kind of strengthen and fortify more of the deeper part of the immune system, the immune reservoir. Talk a little bit about and contrast those herbs, something that would, you know, kill stuff outright versus something you would take which might prevent you from getting something. I'm thinking of it like astragalus.
Yes.
That's like a great example of that.
Yes, I know what you mean. I often call it, you know, specific herbs that are specifically antimicrobial for the germ versus those herbs that have more of a non-specific effect across the whole immune system in that sense. And you're right. I think whatever your foundational piece in your immune system is if you have a weak immune system, you're only going to get so much of a response. But you can build that, like you mentioned, astragalus. I think astragalus is excellent for building the immune system because it builds up a lot of the mucous membranes, which, you know, is one of the areas where our kind of first response immune system, you know, takes place. And so it's an important aspect. And it's also a place that often has a lot of wear and tear. I also like to think of other mucous membrane kind of strengtheners or tonifiers, such as elderflower or plantain leaves. Like astragalus, you know, being more of a immune builder, immune modulator, and a nutrient type of herb, I also like to use the medicinal mushrooms for that type of building, so that if somebody is weak in their first line of defense, where you see that they have chronically runny nose, types of allergies, they get every little thing that comes along, I'm going to do long-term kind of work with improving the immune function and building that up in a more tonifying kind of nurturing way, versus if somebody has immediate where you say, oh, this person has a bacterial infection or a viral infection, and I can use an antiviral such as glycyrrhiza or licorice, or I might use Melissa. I use Andrographis a lot for adenoviruses and rhinoviruses, and those herbs I can use in a larger amount or a higher dose that might definitely wipe out the activity of the virus, versus the other herbs are going to be given in a more long-term way to improve the body's response, so that maybe down the line in a month or two we're going to see this person not getting as many viruses or as many bacterial infections or inflammatory response. And I think that echinacea is another herb that
Let's talk about that because that's interesting. Yeah. There's some mystique, you know, some researchers like I follow a lot of what Kerry Bone's talking about in Australia, where he's doing a lot more targeted research on echinacea. And are there any myths about echinacea that we can dispel on the program here?
That's a great question, Eugene. And
I catch you with some good questions, Mary.
Well, and I think also, you know, even for us as practitioners, you know, over the years, echinacea, you know, myths and you know, have kind of come and gone, and I think that many times we don't even really know for sure, you know, were they really dispelled by a scientific reasoning or not, you know, and I think that some of them have just been things that have come up from the populace. But I started my work on echinacea back when I went to school in England at the School of Phytotherapy, and we had to do a final paper and have it published, and I did mine on echinacea at the time, and I remember coming back to the States in 1988, just after I had published that paper in the European Journal of Phytotherapy.
Ooh.
I know, I was so excited because
very
I
nice.
Graduated, and it was, you know, an exciting kind of thing to have done, and Kerry Bone had been doing a lot of work at the school on echinacea, so I had, you know, kind of done a lot of work kind of in reading his work. And I came back to the States, and there was this thing of, oh, you're going to build up tolerances, and, oh, you can't take it because
all
it's
going to
aggravate autoimmune disease.
Right.
You know, aggravate autoimmune disease. And I thought, geez, you know, I don't remember seeing any of this kind of stuff in any of the research I've just spent a year doing. And then I also, you know, had the which is fortunate enough to actually meet some of the first researchers, Wagner, and on echinacea from Germany. And again, I was not always clear as to, you know, and I think echinacea has now taken, what should we say, a long journey that we now recognize there are many constituents in it, that the constituents change, varying whether it's a part, whether it's a specific species, such as echinacea pallida or Echinacea purpurea versus Echinacea angustifolia, and that even different times of the year will yield us more polysaccharides in a part of a plant versus less and more types of anti-inflammatory.
Like the alkylamides.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I think that when we start to recognize this, that it's also a good learning tool to see that plants do change through the season, their constituents change through the season, and that, you know, a different species can make a big difference as to how we're going to get a medicinal activity.
Let's hold that thought because we need to take a break. Maybe we'll play one of our natural medicine chests, the name of the book that myself and Dr. Kamai wrote, and on herbal medicine, which you can get certainly on a lot of websites and through our website. And so when we be back, we'll continue with Dr. Mary Bowe. There's a lot of other herbal things that we need to discuss as far as various maladies that might plague you throughout this winter season, and we hope that you can stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network with the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay tuned. On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the ancient Chinese science and art of acupuncture.
Acupuncture is a 5,000-year-old medical procedure involving insertion and manipulation of needles into specific points on the body. It is often applied to relieve pain during surgery and for many other conditions.
Acupuncture needles have been found in China that are over 4,000 years old. The first needles were made of stone. Later, bronze, gold, or silver was used, and today they are usually made from steel. Acupuncture was developed around the theory of special meridian points on the body connected to the internal organs, and that vital energy, or qi, flows along these meridians. According to this theory, diseases are caused by interrupted energy flow, and the stimulation of these points restores normal energy circulation. There is some scientific evidence of the existence of the meridians as a separate circulatory system. Studies were done in the 1970s by a Dr. Kim from Korea, where he injected radioactive dyes into the traditional acupuncture points. He observed migration of the dyes along the exact predicted path of the meridians.
Okay. How acupuncture works remains uncertain, but both Western and Eastern scientific studies on rabbits have shown that the analgesic effects are not simply a matter of suggestion. After the discovery in 1975 of endorphins, natural pain inhibitors in the body, some neurophysiologists suggested that the needles may trigger the release of these substances. American and Chinese studies have confirmed that placing acupuncture needles in the brains of dogs raises the level of endorphins in the spinal fluid.
Acupuncture is used today in most hospitals in China and by many private practitioners in virtually every country in the world, including the United States. The primary use is for analgesia, although ulcers, hypertension, asthma, and other conditions have been documented to respond favorably to this treatment. Chinese surgeons prefer acupuncture to the use of drug-induced analgesia because they claim it does not disturb normal body physiology and therefore does not make the patient vulnerable to shock. Brain surgery is especially amenable to this form of analgesia when it is necessary to keep the patient awake during the operation.
Although some modifications in the practice of acupuncture have been made, such as sometimes using a small electric current on the needle instead of the traditional twirling, acupuncture remains intact as an ancient therapeutic technique that has been used successfully for at least 5,000 years. Perhaps you'd like to add this piece of knowledge to your natural medicine chest.
Okay, and we're back with the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and here with our illustrious guest, Dr. Mary Bowe. And, you know, Mary certainly is a luminary in the field, been involved in education of naturopathic doctors, designing her own products for the lay people out there, writing, lecturing, doing radio, and having some great kids, and you know, balancing life too as a practitioner and mom, and just a wonderful person. And we're really glad to have her here. Oh, by the way, she's my classmate too. So we kind of went through naturopathic training together. So Mary, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit, continue our thread about echinacea. Now, some of the research shows that it's anti-inflammatory, and, you know, some of the older, the eclectic doctors who at the turn of the century were kind of like the main MDs, kind of holistic in a way, that would use echinacea and wrote volumes of information on it. You know, they talked about good quality echinacea will make your tongue tingle, and a lot of clinical tidbits, including like treating gangrene and healing wounds and snake bites and just the things that we don't normally associate with echinacea, and then trying to figure out what's the best form of echinacea, or what your opinion is on that. And then also, how do you use echinacea? Because there's even debate on that. Some of the studies I've read have been horrible as far as, you know, they kind of use echinacea, you know, 4 days into a cold when, you know, the old saying is, you know, when a cold gets started, you're going to get better in either a week if you do something or 7 days if you don't. So it's kind of like, it's the idea of like the disease is entrenched and, all, you know, it's like a Mack truck trying to stop the inertia. So just continue your comments on echinacea for us.
Yeah, well, that's good. I think you're right that, you know, if we look at some of the traditional uses in eclectic medicine, we find that echinacea was used for so many more things. We also find that, you know, they were using echinacea angustifolia much more than I think that than present day, where we use angustifolia as well as purpurea. But we do know that the isobutylides, those substances that help to act as anti-inflammatories, you know, typically we're finding them in the roots in the fall harvest, in that time of the you know, of the plant. So it has it's different than the polysaccharides, which are much more immune stimulating. I do think that you know, it is confusing about echinacea in the sense, as you mentioned, that there are a lot of studies that were done that echinacea didn't come out looking good. And I think we can go back and analyze those studies and find numerous kinds of issues that might be varying from the traditional way it was used, the dose, But
yeah.
I think that really, I think we need to look at it as, a herbal medicine that has, you know, multiple effects, and that how are we going to use it? I mean, are we going to, as you said, you get the cold, and is it going to be a week if you do nothing, or is it going to be 7 days? And I think that speaks to us again as to who is the person getting the cold. And what is their general fabric? If their fabric is shot and holy and, you know, not strong, then they don't have a lot to work with. And, of course, they're going to suffer from more of the repercussions of how that virus insults their body. If their body fibers are strong and their fabric is vital and that they have, you know, good functioning circulation and waste and liver and digestion and so forth, that then what the herb has to work with is different, and how the virus will, which we say, insult the body is different. And I think we can, you know, if we look at that sense of, you know, many times the symptoms that we end up with, a lot of congestion and stuffiness and a cough from the phlegm, that a lot of that is an inflammatory reaction that came because of the degree of insult that the body has suffered from having had that viral.
And that's good, right, Mary? I mean, they say, some people say, I've heard Dr. Sensenig say, you earn a cold, and that's good to have a cold. It shows
well, I think,
that, I mean,
for
that's
me,
bizarre.
I think
that's bizarre to the average American. They're like, what? They listen to that and they just can't figure out our philosophy. Well, what does he mean by
whether
that?
Whether you have a healthy cold, in the sense that, as Dr. Fencenik says, yes, so you earn a cold, you get, is the cold a healthy cold, one in which, it's there and it runs its time in a short period of time, you're efficient in the way you have your cold, versus is it not a healthy cold? Is your body really taken back from it, and it doesn't run its course in a healthy amount of time, and it causes a lot of other kinds of, dynamics of damage in the physiology, so that person has a cold for 3 weeks and they still linger with their cough for another week after that, versus the person who's efficient and has used that cold to improve their immune dynamic. Certainly, I think that person, the cold is gone from in, 5 to 7 days and they're back up and running. And I think that's the difference, is that a lot of people, don't respond well to having it, and then they are insulted strongly from that. So, and I think that by building the overall body, the immune system, feeding the body well and keeping the body warm and improving circulation, that we can interface with having a cold better. Because if we didn't have illness, then our immune system would be very weak.
That's a good
point. Kind of like
what
people are finding now with what's happening with the whole probiotic and the microbiota and the biofilms, is like, that now we have all these germs because we've been so sterile in our gut that now we lose that dynamic. And so so I think in just recognizing that we're susceptible to more germs because we've killed so many of the friendly germs in our body and in our food state, that it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, my grandfather used to say you eat a pound of dirt before you die. He'd have all these great words of wisdom, and I'd say, wow, that's pretty interesting, Grandpa.
It is. Well, just like, people say, feed a cold and starve a fever, and it makes so much sense. If you feed a child with a fever, you'll push that fever. If a child who's feverish and you take their temperature after you've given them food, it's going to be higher. But if the body generally with a fever doesn't want to eat. The body says, no, I don't want to eat. And what it does is it kicks in to its own fever system, and it says, oh, I'm just going to use a little bit of the body's protein reserve for what I need during the time I'm fever, so I'm not going to eat. And we burn a little bit of our protein from our muscles, so hence we have sore muscles during a fever, because we've used that to sustain our calorie need while we're feverish, because if we were to eat food, we would just make the fever worse. And so it's a funny old saying that Grandma said, but she was kind of smart.
Yeah. It was. I read, because I teach history of naturopathic medicine, it was developed by that Samuel Thompson, who led a whole revolution in herbal medicine, his Thompsonian stuff, where he would use a lot of herbs to induce sweating and sometimes purging. People don't like the purge, either on the toilet or vomiting, but sometimes, purging and opening up the emunctories or the different waste elimination things is very paramount to healthy immunity. Do you think that there's some kind of scientific validity to that when it comes to our immune system and opening up the emunctories or the waste passages in our body?
Certainly, I absolutely believe that, and I see it in clinic, and I see it with a lot of my pediatric medicine, is that when small children and babies get sick with colds and get that type of acute illness, a lot of times they get shut down in their bowel, and so they don't eliminate as well. And a simple small amount of water or a simple bulb enema can often open up that area, and then all of a sudden you see them decongested, you see the fever start to switch, and you start to see their body recovering better. And I know that when we use castor oil pack, that castor oil pack over the liver is a decongestion and helps the liver to detoxify and move out and support that emunctory function. And we know in research that it does, that it has anti-inflammatory effects, that it's been shown to change the dynamic of output and liver detoxification and to stimulate white blood cell activity in that area. So we do know that supporting that part of the process, we do support the immune system in getting rid of the waste. And I also think that just in remembering that it's not just about bowel waste, but kidney waste too, and fluids. And so many times when we have a cold or we're ill, you know, if we have a fever, we may be thirsty, but a lot of times we forget to keep hydrated, because hydration is another way in which we support the emunctories, but it also is a way in which we support the immune system.
Turns out a lot of the herbs that, you know, an herbalist would put together are not only, like you see, herbs. You know, herbs didn't read the herb books. They do a lot of things, and we can't put them in a compartment. So some of the very herbs that you mentioned earlier, even like echinacea and baptistia and some of these things, are what we call alteratives, which means it kind of builds health and wellness by opening up the emunctories and moving the lymph and working with the liver and the bowels and things like that. That these are actually part of our defense system. The way I look at the immune system, and I teach the immune system very different than other, you know, doctors. I guess naturopaths teach it like this too, but I call it like the greater defensive system. That, you know, the macrophages, the Pac-Man in our liver and our lymph system, and our spleen and our gut, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, and our mucosa and our skin, and the hydrochloric acid in our stomach, and, you know, all of this are antioxidants. They're all part of the defensive system, Dr. Bo.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about it, it's really multi-systemic. The immune system's not just, you know, kind of in your bone marrows and maybe swimming around in the mucosa. It's very deep.
And I think that's an important image to put out there for people so that they recognize it. I often tell people, it's like a department store. It's not like you just have the immune system. It's the immune system's a department store. And for every department you have in the department store, women's, children's, you know, housing, tools, you have that in your immune system. It is doing all of these functions. So people say, oh, I never get sick, so I must be really strong in my immune system. Well, you might be strong in that department.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that the other departments in your immune system are functioning up to par. And I think that, you know, once we recognize that it's everywhere and that it has its fingers in everything that is happening in our body, that really helps us to see the importance of it. And we're talking about the herbs like baptisia and echinacea being alterative to help with just improving the underlying health. And you're talking about Samuel Thompson, and he had his composition essence was his formulas that he used for helping to chase away that kind of cold and to improve warming and to get illness out. And that's a remedy that I have always found to be very, very helpful in both preventing multiple colds and building the immune system, as well as cutting mucus and acting as a decongestant and warming the stomach if the stomach's nauseous and so forth. And that's one of the remedies that was, let's see, a driving factor for me in when I chose remedies to put together for the line that I did for Gaia Herbs, was based on Samuel Thompson's.
Isn't that great?
Business.
Not a lot of people know about him and his work. You know, we teach that in our program. I don't even remember learning that in our history class at Bastyr, but I make sure I teach it to people and the physiomedicalists and the eclectics, and kind of go through the history of medicine and their contributions towards our understanding. So I guess in the last about 6-7 minutes, let's kind of tie up some of the loose ends. We spoke about herbs and how they work, and hydrotherapy, and overall diet and lifestyle issues. Is there anything that that we need to address to keep ourselves healthy that we haven't mentioned?
Well, there are some basic kinds of things that I talk
about. Oh, hold on for a sec. How about stress?
Sure. stress.
How about stress? We didn't talk about stress because, you know, a lot of the herbs that are for stress really aren't thought of as immune herbs. But again, that's that myopic herbalism, thinking, okay, one thing is for one thing. But you mentioned, for instance, like lemon balm, Melissa, that kills viruses. Well, that's also a main remedy for seasonal affective disorder and stress. Am I right?
Absolutely. Also, it's an excellent remedy for ADD and for insomnia and for improved cognitive function. And I think that you're right. I think that we sometimes forget that stress, you know, does inhibit our immune response. And for kids, it also, high amounts of stress and can affect the way that they learn, focus, and development and growth for kids. And one of the things that I try to remind parents is that kids are susceptible not only to their own stress, but if they're witnessing their parents under stress, then that increases their stress load tremendously. And then hence, you know, many times that's manifested as an illness such as, a headache or chronic respiratory issue, asthma, and or stomach ache. And the herb Melissa is one of the herbs that I fall back on often, you know, just for that reason, because it helps with, if you have a virus going on and that's made you congested and you're not sleeping well, then Melissa will, you know, not only help as an antiviral and an immune support herb, but it's also going to, you know, help be helpful if you're using it at nighttime to improve your sleep so it's not as disrupted from your illness.
And sleep, of course, disrupted sleep further messes up your immune. I tell you, the only time, knock on wood, the only time that I really get sick or remember a period of getting sick was during school, during finals week, Mary. During finals week, me and Jonathan and a whole bunch
week.
Of, we'd all get together and pull all-nighters to study, and maybe we'd make chocolate chip cookies or something like that as comfort food, which maybe wasn't the best thing to do, but we kind of had to. We didn't want to drink coffee, even though Seattle is like the, we went to school before Starbucks was really big across the world, right? But nonetheless, that's when I noticed that, you know, that first tickling in my throat, it starts in me. When I feel that, I'm like, uh-oh, what have I done?
Yeah.
What could I do? So in the last couple of minutes, walk us through some ways that you would, help people, give them some really good steps as to what they can do if they're feeling under the weather, you know, with the holidays coming up and they ate a lot for Thanksgiving, maybe things they shouldn't have, like too much sugar and refined foods and baked goods and whatnot. They may be starting to come down with something now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, baseline, given the fact that, as you mentioned earlier, our immune system does sit in our gut, because I tell people, you know, in the winter, it's a good idea to take some probiotics on a regular basis. We typically have someone take 25 to 50,000 billion, you know, post their meal once a day. And then I often make sure that they're on several grams of omega-3 oils so that they have extra fish oils. And then I do a lot with colored fruits and vegetables and or bioflavonoids. So many times people, you know, can't get enough fruits and vegetables for my liking. If they're a person who'll do juicing, then that's great. If not, then I want them on a high food-based bioflavonoid so that they've got those antioxidants. And then herbal-wise, you know, there are some nice herbal types of products out there. You can do an elderberry with a zinc chewable kind of lozenger, giving a lot more throat. You can use things that have essential oils, like some of your essential oil lozengers, and that will constantly cleanse out your respiratory passages, helping to minimize viral activity. I talk to people about the fact, get enough sleep now. Get yourself into bed and make sure that you get a good 8 hours. Stay hydrated. Take that extra vitamin C if you're a vitamin C person. And and then if they want herbal medicine, if they're a person who's swallowing tablets, I typically will use andrographis as a preventative one or two times a day. Sometimes I'll use a combination of propolis and echinacea and vitamin C, and I've found that to be very, very helpful. Propolis has 300 different constituents, and many of those are antimicrobial. So propolis has a throat spray.
Yeah, leave it to the bees, you know?
Yeah, leave it to the bees. I think sometimes it's underused so that, you know, a spray of propolis, you know, each morning and each night can really minimize what's going on or coming into your, you know, passages through your throat.
Right. Tell us a little bit about your website and where you're practicing and your line of herbs and some of your books before we say goodbye for the program.
Well, we do have a website, and that's I have a website under Brattleboro Naturopathic Clinic, which is here in Brattleboro, Vermont, and we have a naturopathic clinic. There are several doctors in the clinic. We do home birthing. I don't do home birthing anymore, but one of the docs do. We also have about a half an acre of herbs that we've cultivated, and we do a lot of our own dried herbs and salves and dried herb teas. We make a few special kinds of teas that are medicinal teas. I like people to use herbal teas. And particularly in my book, The Encyclopedia of Natural Healing for Children and Infants, there's a recipe section in the book. And in that section, there's something called Herbal Punch for Kids. And I often recommend people to make that punch up and use that punch as a beverage every day with your children. And it really helps to support the immune system, support the emunctures, keep you warm, keep the mucous membranes hydrated.
And it tastes good. I've used it on my kids for years.
It is.
They look forward to, well, when they were younger, they used to, they should probably do it now still.
Yeah, exactly, you know. So, like, you know, I would certainly say that that is a, you know, a great resource. The
and what's your website?
Is that section. And that's, the website is www.BrattleboroNaturopathic.com.
Okay, great. Hey, Mary, it's been a fabulous discussion. We kind of weaved a very nice foundation for people. If they listen to this show, I really think that they could have a healthy winter season this year.
I think so, too, and I think they can do that without a flu shot, which would really be a wonderful thing for their body.
Yeah. Thank you very much for being a guest right here on the Natural Nurse and Dr.
Time.
Z. Great to have you on, and keep up the great
happy
work.
Happy holidays to you and your family.
You too. Hopefully see you in the flesh soon. I really enjoyed seeing you at the University of Bridgeport gathering there. And
I
next year, actually, we're having the gathering at
the
UB. So hopefully we'll see you then if we don't see you sooner. Take care, everyone, and have a wonderful day, and keep healthy. Bye-bye.